situation in southern regions. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As more cases of the Omicron variant of COVID-19 are detected in Europe, questions mount over its true origin, how contagious it is, and of course the health threat. The matter was debated in the European Parliament on Tuesday.
The thing that's really on everybody's mind is the new variant.
The head of the European Medicines Agency, Eimear Cook, told lawmakers that greater efforts are needed to get more people vaccinated in the EU.
Especially in those member states where the rates are dangerously low. And this is particularly important as we learn more about Omicron.
Even though we know little about the new variant, EU countries are increasing restrictions. Most legislators agree that vaccination rollout remains key.
We were all a bit late in preparing the booster. And it is the biggest problem is, of course, that people don't get the first and second dose.
Citizens have been reacting to the latest developments.
With this new variant, well, I don't know. I mean, the economy is not actually quite strong, I would say. So whether we really balance like health, you know, and survival.
From the stock exchange's reaction, it may have a negative impact on our lives again in terms of economy.
One quarter of adults in the EU have still not been jabbed. A contributing factor to hesitancy, it has been suggested, is the refusal of pharmaceutical giants to release vaccine clinical trial data.
This is not just an issue of taxpayers' funds, but also an issue of trust. Trust in the European institution can be built by transparency.
Many EU legislators are saying it's imperative that Omicron serves as a warning. They are again repeating a message they've been trying to send to political leaders now for almost a year. The West must stop hoarding vaccines from poorer nations, otherwise more variants, and perhaps more deadly variants, will be coming. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Tensions are running high between the United States and China as Washington ramps up pressure against Beijing. The Pentagon says it is planning to improve bases in Guam and Australia to counter what it calls the threat from China. The projects come as part of the U.S. military's Global Poster Review, which calls for prioritizing military construction across the Pacific Islands and additionally military cooperation with allies and partners in the region. Beijing has slammed the plan, accusing the U.S. of creating an imaginary enemy and sparing no efforts to encircle and contain China. It says Washington is using the China threat theory to expand its military presence in the region and serve its hegemonic interests. Since coming to power, President Biden has made China his main foreign policy agenda, with a focus on the Indo-Pacific region. Taiwan has been a major thorn in the deteriorating relations, as Washington has been trying to appease Taipei by arming it. That's despite repeated warnings from Beijing, which views the self-ruled island as part of its territory under the One China principle. The Sino-American standoff is not limited to Taiwan. The two have been at odds over a host of other issues. Beijing has repeatedly accused Washington of interfering in its internal affairs by fueling unrest in the semi-autonomous Chinese city of Hong Kong. Washington has also sided with Beijing's rivals in the maritime dispute over the South China Sea and routinely dispatches warships and warplanes to the region. China and the U.S. are also engaged in a trade war, with both seen imposing tit-for-tat tariffs during the previous U.S. administration. The Sino-American relationship has also deteriorated over a recently inked security pact between the U.S., Australia, and the U.K., known as AUKUS. Beijing says the trilateral partnership, which allows Australia to build nuclear-powered submarines, poses both a regional and global threat. Russian President Vladimir Putin has also accused the AUKUS alliance of fueling regional tensions. Putin's comments come as tensions are also running high between Russia and the West over a series of issues, including Ukraine. The pressure tactic by the U.S. and its allies have driven Moscow and Beijing closer than ever. Earlier this month, they signed a roadmap for closer military ties, citing growing conflict potential and frequent U.S. strategic bomber flights near their borders. Russia and China have realized that the American hegemonic goal, if unchecked, would pose a threat not only to their geostrategic interests, but other countries in the region and beyond.
No kings or queens, but a president from the ranks of Barbadians charting a path forward for the world's youngest republic.
Today, debate and discourse have become action. Today, we set our compass to a new direction, girded by the successes of the last 55 years, buoyed by the confidence garnered from our triumphs and accomplishments.
One of those accomplishments, independence from monarchical rule in 1966, more than three centuries after British settlers arrived and turned the island into a wealthy sugar colony based on the work of hundreds of thousands of African slaves. The UK's Prince Charles, who stood somberly as the new Barbados was declared, had this to say.
From the darkest days of our past and the appalling atrocity of slavery, which forever stains our history, the people of this island forged their path with extraordinary fortitude.
Some experts are saying that Barbados becoming a republic is the natural progression of a trend that started in 1952 when Queen Elizabeth II acceded to the throne, that it will accelerate, not necessarily in this reign, but perhaps in the next.
The brutal history in Barbados and other Caribbean islands has also spurred calls for reparations from the UK. For now, though, this republic of nearly 300,000 will be celebrating throwing off the shackles of British colonialism and focus on building their future Barbadian style. Saeed Pourriza, London.
The nations of the English Channel and the European Commission convened in Paris following the deadliest mass drowning on record. The United Kingdom was excluded, a controversial punishment for UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's public tweet asking for joint military patrols and renegotiations of emigration agreements. At the request of London, for the past 3 years, France has blocked all other routes to the UK, leaving dangerous sea crossings the only option. Many say that when it comes to refugees, what comes first is political considerations and not humanitarian obligations.
Once again, we're in a French election campaign which wants to scapegoat immigrants for political gain. The three top candidates, including President Emmanuel Macron, are all awful and also on the far right. Therefore, they emphasize falsehoods such as immigrants cost the state too much money, even though every study proves that the state grows fat from the taxes and cheap labor of illegal immigrants.
Primary motivation cited by refugees is to be with family members in the United Kingdom, a neo-colonial power. French officials accuse the UK of economically profiting off of quasi-modern slavery by attracting refugees with the lure of not needing papers to work in the UK. Despite being militarily involved in many of the world's top refugee-producing conflicts today, the UK currently hosts around 200,000 of the world's 84 million refugees. Refugees compose just 0.25% of the UK population, while countries like Iran and Lebanon host well over 1 million asylum seekers each. Many note that while Brexit has taken the UK out of the European Union, it has not removed its commitments to international law.
France said the easiest solution is for the United Kingdom to widen its legal route for asylum seekers. Paris has long offered to let British immigration officials process asylum requests on French soil. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Time to get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Monlay.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. U.S. President Joe Biden is under fire for restoring a controversial immigration program his predecessor Donald Trump launched to stem the flow of migrants at the Mexico border. The program requires migrants to wait in Mexico, sometimes for months, while their claims are processed in the U.S. Biden suspended the program after taking office in January this year, but now he has to restore it beginning from next week following a federal court judge's order back in August. The Biden administration has even taken into account the humanitarian concerns raised by Mexico, but still he's facing criticism. Rights groups say restoring the program would spur violence in border camps, and the UN Refugee Agency also says the move puts asylum seekers at risk. Some lawmakers from Biden's Democratic Party have urged him to fight the order in court. Joining us right now is our correspondent, Colin Campbell, who's with us from Washington. Colin, tell us more about the re-implementation of this Remain in Mexico policy.
Yeah, after reaching a deal with Mexico, this policy will start to take place within the next few days. But what the Biden administration says is different from the previous administration is that those seeking asylum and that have to remain in Mexico will have their situation resolved within 6 months instead of an undetermined amount of time that they were facing during the Trump administration, where people who are seeking asylum had to return to Mexico and then were held there without really any information on how long they would be there. The Biden administration says that it wants to work expeditiously with different individuals and families and pair them with counselors, with attorneys, so that their situation can be ameliorated as quickly as possible. Now, this was something that came to terms with Mexico after a deal was reached because of the amount of people wanting to seek asylum in the U.S. coming through Mexico, but not having the legal resources, nor sometimes the physical resources to support them. So this new deal was reached, and of course, there's a lot of controversy because of the fact that they're returning people back to Mexico when their original destination was the United States.
All right, thanks a lot. That was Colin Campbell joining us from Washington. But joining us on tonight's edition of the Spotlight, we have columnist at Black Agenda Report, Marguerite Kimberly, who's with us from New York, and also international lawyer and human rights expert John Philpott, joining us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So starting off with Mr. Philpott in Montreal, sir, talk to us about the re-implementation of this Remain in Mexico policy and basically issues that our correspondent was mentioning a little earlier about any differences that there will be from the Trump-era version of it.
Well, I've had the experience in Canada of people being required to make their claims from outside the country, and it imbalances, creates a great big imbalance in the process because the person's not in the country, and as our journalist pointed out, they're going to send some people back to Mexico to determine this policy, to determine. So it's an unequal and unfair system to have your status determined from outside the country. And we all know also that your U.S. Jurisdiction for refugee status is extremely difficult. And so I think it's very, very unfair. And many people in the States and in Canada kind of like to think, oh, well, Biden's great and Trump's a devil. But in fact, they're kind of the same thing. And I've seen on almost every other issue that Biden is not much better than Trump. And so this is extremely worrying. And we got to remember that in Latin America, and we can look at Honduras until 2 days ago or 3 days ago, and countries like Colombia and Ecuador, those countries produce refugees, which are legitimate political refugees who need help, and they should be welcomed in the U.S. and dealt with by law. And so I find it very worrying, and it's a way for the U.S. to avoid its obligations under the refugee treaty, which was signed some 70 years ago. And so I think it's really a big mistake.
Let's bring in Ms. Kimberly from New York on the discussion. Ms. Kimberly, Biden called out Trump during the presidential debates, blasting him for being the first president ever to make people seek asylum in another country. Well, Joe Biden is number two on that list now.
Yes, he is. It's one more example of how Trump foreign policy has become Biden's foreign policy. As the other guest pointed out, you know, people cannot adequately apply for asylum if they aren't in the country they're trying to enter. The system is very deliberately made difficult for people to navigate. And if you're not even in the United States, it's almost impossible to really have an application that has a chance of being accepted. And most asylum applications are rejected, in fact. So people have legitimate claims in Central Americans, Haitians, you know, people are using the border to come from literally all over the world, not just this hemisphere. And because of U.S. policies, their countries are just unlivable. Haiti, for example, is all of its problems are caused by the United States. Honduras just had an election, but the U.S. overthrew a government when Obama was president, another Democrat, and there was a great deal of violence and danger for people there. So they have a legitimate reason to apply.
That's right, Mr. Philpott. The Biden administration, well, basically they're saying the policy is being imposed again, not because they want to, but because they have to. Critics, on the other hand, are saying that the administration is actually welcoming it to bring down migrant numbers, which are at a 21-year high in July. Do you agree with that notion?
I don't agree that they have to, because any legislative authority can go beyond a legal decision out of the principle of legislative sovereignty. So they are not forced to do it. They can change the laws and allow these immigrants, these refugees, to enter the country. That is a nonsense argument. And as Margaret Kimberly pointed out, and as you pointed out, there's a growing flow of refugees. And this is a test to the gravity and inequality of our neoliberal imperial economic system and growing U.S. Monroe Doctrine style intervention in Latin America, where if a country steps out of line, they apply sanctions, and they force other countries to stay in line and support repressive governments, leaving these people, and I don't know how many there are, hundreds of thousands, in limbo and trying to escape their governments, escape the situations, and obtain status in the United States. Ironically, of course, the United States probably needs immigrants still, but maybe they don't want as many people whose color is not absolutely purely white. I'm not sure about that, but that would seem like a logical conclusion.
Ms. Kimberly, the policy and the words of the Biden administration have been revamped to address humanitarian concerns. The Department of Homeland Security, to be specific, says the changes will include certain, quote, certain humanitarian improvements. Now, all kinds of terrible things are happening to these people. We're waiting for their asylum request to be processed in Mexico, a country that is not their own, most likely, most of those migrants. How can that change? Logistically, is that even possible to improve the humanitarian situation and conditions for them?
Well, it could change if there is an acceptance of the reality that there are so many people who want to leave their homelands. And the first change is for the United States to not be the cause of their problems. People don't want to be in a caravan for weeks to come here unless they're very desperate. So the first issue is the United States not being part of their problem, which is a heavy lift because that these are the imperatives of imperialism. But so there has to be a recognition of the U.S. role. There has to be a recognition that this is something that's not just going away. It's a political issue, a difficult political issue to navigate. Most people in the country do not want people to seek asylum on the border and have very negative opinions about it, but it is a reality. And this administration, which is supposed to be so much better than Trump, but which has already deported more Haitians than the Trump administration did, it's time for them to put up or shut up and put the mechanisms in place to make sure that this process can be handled in a humane way that respects international law.
Mr. Philpott, humanitarian organizations are saying the U.S. is basically rejecting people to danger and death, and now they want to give a gentler version of an already deadly policy. Unpack that for us.
Well, I think that stresses the fact that the Biden administration is little different than the Trump administration. They put a few more sugar on their words, but the mistreatment and buffeting and throwing around of these people who are streaming into the U.S. is carried out pretty much the same way, and those criticisms are valid, and the U.S. has to change its approach. And we're talking about more deeper issues with respect to the U.S. and its policy, its foreign policy, and we can easily get into the concept of multilateralism, ending intervention, ending Monroe Doctrine, ending interfering in the elections in foreign countries and other countries. But I guess this may go beyond the scope of today's discussion.
Right, Ms. Kimberly, let's talk about what put a halt to the policy in the first place and how it was ordered to be reinstated by the Supreme Court. What's the basis of this ruling?
Well, the basis of the ruling is that this is U.S. law. This is the way it was always done. Trump is the one who made the change, but this is what U.S. policy ought to be. I'm not certain that the Biden administration is not opposed to it. I think they probably breathe a sigh of relief because they get to say, well, we wanted to be different than Trump, but, you know, this court ruling says that, mm-hmm. that we have to do what Trump did. It's not really what we want to do, but that's a phony assertion. They have the same policies on immigration as past presidents, unless we forget Obama was the deporter-in-chief, deporting more people than all of his predecessors. Trump, as horrible as he was supposed to be, and he was horrible in many ways, and despite his rhetoric, deported fewer people in his one term than Obama did in his first. So it's important that this rule, it should, I hope that it does stand. And it forces the Biden administration to be honest and not pretend, as they did with campaign rhetoric, that they're going to be more humane when that's actually not what they intend to do.
Ms. Kimberly, I'm going to stay with you for this one. Why would Mexico agree to this? Those people, they're not Mexican citizens. They're coming from Central America, from South America. What is Mexico's position on this?
Well, I think that Mexico probably, Mexico's in a difficult position. I'm sure there's pressure on them from, including from perhaps their own population. This is a creates some difficulty for them. But Mexico has all sorts of relations with the United States. So it's unclear why they are going along with this policy of people having to stay in their country order to apply for asylum when they would prefer that this not be true. So that's some information we should be on the lookout for.
Sure. Mr. Philpott, would you like to talk to us about Mexico's position on the issue?
Well, I think Margaret Kimberly has hit it. It's not Mexico's decision. It's Mexico saying, I think, what can we do?
Right.
And Mexico wants to be sovereign. It's historically attempted to be sovereign. It's acting in a sovereign manner in many of its international relations, relations with Cuba, breaking the U.S. blockade on Cuba, recognizing the Maduro government. So it's acting as a fairly independent country and in maturing politically from I as an outsider, I'm not Mexican, in many ways. But I think they're kind of like stuck with this. That's my reading, but and Ms. Kimberly may clarify this a bit more. I don't know.
Would you like to clarify that more?
I think saying stuck is it's a short and sweet answer, but I think it does sum it up, yes.
All right, let's look at this in the bigger picture. Mr. Philpott, is this, in your opinion, hypocritical of countries like the United States, who are self-proclaimed champions of human rights, not allowing asylum seekers their due process?
Well, this idea that the U.S. champions human rights, we could have another two-hour interview on that. That's tongue-in-cheek, of course.
I can set that up if you want.
No, I'm not an expert in the U.S., but they have so many people in prison on a racial basis, so many people with long sentences. It's probably one of the most retrograde countries with respect to human rights. And human rights includes social and economic rights, voting rights. The voting rights in the U.S. are terrible. The social economic rights of American citizens are terrible. The right to life, it's one of the most backward countries with 800,000 dead? China has 5,000 or so. And everyone says, well, maybe we don't believe China. I'm sorry. We have to take that seriously. So I couldn't even embark with the idea that the U.S. is a champion of human rights. It's only a champion of human rights if it can intervene in a foreign election or in a foreign country and try and overthrow the government. And I'm not exaggerating.
Ms. Kimberly, your thoughts on the issue, on the same question?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, the U.S. is the world's biggest jailer, more people in prison than any other country, a bigger percentage of its population in prison than any other country, the largest military budget, which is inherently undemocratic, 800 bases all over the world, which by definition deprive people, governments and their people of their sovereign rights. Yes, more than 800,000 deaths from COVID-19. And at the same time, our neoliberal austerities closing hospitals, no free health care. Some COVID treatments were free, but now they've announced no more free ride. You have to pay, and hopefully your horrible insurance company, if you have insurance at all, will pay your bills. Police killings, by any standard, Americans are not doing well in a variety of ways, and our country does not respect human rights, but will claim that it is destroying another country on the basis of protecting human rights somewhere else, this responsibility to protect, which was a scam ginned up to justify the U.S. Bombing and droning and invading and interfering in targeted nations, and to put it add insult to injury, Biden is having this democracy summit next week, and they've decided who's a democracy, which country is a democracy and which isn't. And any country the U.S. doesn't like, they've declared is not democratic, even when some of those countries are in fact more democratic than ours.
And Mr. Philpott, similar events are taking place in Europe as well. Let's not forget that part of the Atlantic. Why are these countries not offering the asylum seekers their rights, not allowing them their due process?
Well, the issue of immigration is not the only issue, because we see why people are fleeing. And the particular one which sticks in my mind is the Syrians who flooded into Europe.
Sure.
But the country was destroyed by the U.S. and the U.S. proxies. And now Europeans don't want Syrians to return. They want to return. And these are things, this is a very big subject, which I hesitate to generalize about, because, you know, we don't want people to be political or economic refugees to flee into our countries, although they're welcome as far as I'm concerned. The ideal world would be that the countries which are poorer and under U.S. control or with dictatorships, they should evolve. But that's another question which, again, goes beyond our discussions now. And Europe, we look at the question of people crossing from North Africa to in boats. Well, if they hadn't bombed Libya, it wouldn't be as bad. And if they didn't have slave markets in Libya since the U.S. bombed the U.S. Canada, I'm from Canada, Europe bombed Libya, we would have a different situation. And the Africans working in Libya were working in Libya because they had good jobs. That's my understanding of it. I'm not an expert.
All right. And your final thoughts on the issue, Ms. Kimberly?
Well, yes, I would just like to add on to what Mr. Philpott has said. The United States and its allies are directly responsible for this refugee crisis in Europe. The United States and NATO destroying Libya 10 years ago, attempting to destroy Syria, crippling sanctions against Syria, which have made life miserable for people. Of course, people are trying to get to Europe, but there is no acknowledgement of the role they played in this crisis. So Britain and France arguing back and forth about who's at fault. I remember the Prime Minister of the UK and the President of France directly going to Libya it was really sickening to me that they personally went there to dance on Gaddafi's grave, so to speak. And now neither of those countries will acknowledge the role that it played in creating this refugee crisis.
All right. That's all the time we have for this program. Allow me to thank my guests, columnist at the Black Agenda Report, Margaret Kimberly, joining us from New York. Also, thanks to international lawyer and human rights expert John Philpott, speaking to us from Montreal. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on this edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
However horrifying the January 6th riot at the US Capitol appeared in the moment, we now know that it was far worse. The country was hours away from a full-blown constitutional crisis, not primarily because of the violence and mayhem inflicted by hundreds of President Donald Trump's supporters, but because of the actions of Donald Trump himself. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece is titled, January 6th Was Worse Than We Knew. The editorial board is a group of opinion journalists whose views are informed by expertise, research, and debate. However horrifying the January 6th riot at the US Capitol appeared in the moment, we now know that it was far worse. The country was hours away from a full-blown constitutional crisis, not primarily because of the violence and mayhem inflicted by hundreds of President Donald Trump's supporters, but because of the actions of Donald Trump himself. In the days before the mob descended on the Capitol, a corollary attack, this one bloodless and legalistic, was playing out down the street in the White House, where Mr. Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, and a lawyer named John Eastman huddled in the Oval Office, scheming to subvert the will of the American people by using legal sleight of hand. John Eastman's unusual visit was reported at the time, but a new book by the Washington Post journalists Bob Woodward and Robert Costa provides the details of his proposed six-point plan. It involved Vice President Mike Pence rejecting dozens of already certified electoral votes representing tens of millions of legally cast ballots, thus allowing Congress to install Donald Trump in a second term. Mike Pence ultimately refused to sign on, earning him the rage of Donald Trump and chants of "Hang Mike Pence" by the rioters, who erected a makeshift gallows on the National Mall. The fact that the scheme to overturn the election was highly unlikely to succeed is cold comfort. Donald Trump remains the most popular Republican in the country. Barring a serious health issue, the odds are good that he will be the party's nominee for president in 2024. He also remains as incapable of accepting defeat as he has ever been, which means the country faces a renewed risk of electoral subversion by Donald Trump and his supporters. Only next time, they will have learned from their mistakes. That leaves all Americans who care about preserving this republic with a clear task. Reform the federal election law at the heart of Mr. Eastman's twisted ploy and make it as hard as possible for anyone to pull a stunt like that again. The Electoral Counter Act, which passed more than 130 years ago, was Congress's response to another dramatic presidential dispute, the election of 1876, in which the Republican Rutherford Hayes won the White House despite losing the popular vote to his Democratic opponent, Samuel Tilden. After Election Day, Samuel Tilden led in the popular vote and in the Electoral College, but the vote in three southern states, South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana, was marred by accusations of fraud and intimidation by both political parties. Various officials in each state certified competing slates of electors, one for Rutherford Hayes and the other one for Samuel Tilden. The Constitution said nothing about what to do in such a situation, so Congress established a 15-member commission to decide which electors to accept as valid. The commission consisted of 10 members of Congress, evenly divided between the two political parties, and 5 Supreme Court justices, 2 appointed by Democrats and 3 appointed by Republicans. Rutherford Hayes, the Republican candidate, won all the disputed electors, including one from Oregon, by an 8-7 vote, giving him victory in the Electoral College by just a single vote. Democrats were furious and began to filibuster the counting process, but they eventually accepted Rutherford Hayes' presidency in exchange for the withdrawal of the last remaining federal troops from the South, ending Reconstruction and beginning the era of Jim Crow, which would last until the middle of the 20th century. It was obvious that Congress needed clearer guidelines for deciding disputed electoral votes. In 1887, the Electoral Count Act became law, setting out procedures for the counting and certifying of electoral votes in the states and in Congress. But the law contains numerous ambiguities and poorly drafted provisions. For instance, it permits a state legislature to appoint electors on its own, regardless of how the state's own citizens voted, if the state failed to make a choice on election day. But what does that mean? The law doesn't say. It also allows any objection to a state's electoral votes to be filed as long as just one senator and one member of the House put their names to it, triggering hours of debate, which is how senators like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley were able to gum up the works on 6th of January. A small minority of legal scholars have argued that key parts of the Electoral Count Act are unconstitutional, which was the basis of John Eastman's claim that Mike Pence could simply disregard the law and summarily reject electors of certain key battleground states. Nothing in the Constitution or federal law gives the vice president this authority. The job of the vice president is to open the envelopes and read out the results, and nothing more. Any reform of the Electoral Count Act should start there, by making it explicit that the vice president's role on 6th of January is purely ministerial and doesn't include the power to rule on disputes over electors. The law should also be amended to allow states more time to arrive at a final count so that any legal disputes can be resolved before the electors cast their ballots. The failed election provision should be restricted to natural disasters or terrorist attacks, and even then, it should be available only if there is no realistic way of conducting the election. Remember that in 2012, election was held just days after Hurricane Sandy lashed the East Coast, and yet all states were able to conduct their elections in full. This is another good argument for universal mail-in voting, which doesn't put voters at the mercy of the weather. The key point is that a close election, even a disputed election, is not a failed election. Finally, any objection to a state's electoral votes should have to clear a high bar. Rather than just one member of each chamber of Congress, it should require the assent of one quarter or more of each body. The grounds for an objection should be strictly limited to cases involving clear evidence of fraud or widespread voting irregularities. The threats to a free and fair presidential election don't come from Congress alone. Since 6th of January, Republican-led state legislatures have been clambering over one another to pass new laws making it easier to reject their own voters' will and removing or neutralizing those officials who could stand in the way of a naked power grab, like Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, like he did when he resisted Donald Trump's personal plea to find just enough extra votes to flip the outcome in Georgia. How to ensure that frivolous objections are rejected while legitimate ones get a hearing? One approach would be to establish a panel of federal judges in each state to hear any challenges to the validity or accuracy of the state's election results. If the judges determine that the results are invalid, they would lay out their findings in writing and prevent the state from certifying the results. There is plenty more to be done to protect American elections from being stolen through subversion, like mandating the use of paper ballots that can be checked against reported results. Ideally, fixes like these would be adopted promptly by bipartisan majorities in Congress to convey to all Americans that both political parties are committed to a fair, transparent, and smooth vote-counting process. But for that to happen, the Republican Party would need to do a U-turn. Right now, some Republican leaders in Congress and the states have shown less interest in preventing election sabotage than in protecting and, in some cases, even venerating the saboteurs. Democrats should push through these reforms now and eliminate the filibuster if that's the only way to do so. If they hesitate, they should recall that a majority of the Republican caucus in the House, 139 members to be exact, along with 8 senators, continue to object to the certification of electoral votes even after the mob stormed the Capitol building. Time and distance from those events could have led to reflection and contrition on the part of those involved, but that's not so. Remember how, in the frantic days before 6th of January, Donald Trump insisted over and over again that Georgia's election was rife with large-scale voter fraud. Remember how he called on Mr. Raffensperger to start the process of decertifying the election and announce the true winner. Only those words aren't from last year. They actually appear in a letter that Donald Trump sent to Mr. Raffensperger just 2 weeks ago. Donald Trump may never stop trying to undermine American democracy. Those who value that democracy should never stop using every measure at their disposal to protect it.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.